Hi, I'm WTOP Entertainment Editor Jason Fraley, and I'm here with Director Jay Roach of the new movie Trumbo and a bunch of other ones, Austin Powers, Meet the Parents, the list, Game Change, the list goes on and on. Thanks so much for joining us
here. Oh, no, it's really cool to be here. Thanks for the interest.
Now, before we dive into Trumbo, we were just chit-chatting here a little bit about radio, and he was saying that, you know, that he got into editing and film and everything through working in radio. Let's go into that a little first.
That's right. I was pre-law at Stanford, an econ major, and I started working at KZSU, doing halftime shows, but I evolved into public affairs. I ended up being the public affairs programming director for 1 year. Nice. And started learning to edit the reel-to-reel tape with razor blades and tape, and felt like telling a story by putting pieces together in different orders, and that led to being interested in film. Got out of pre-law and applied to film school.
And then you were actually cutting together that film, except it was film and not audio, right?
That's right. We ended up learning a lot of useless, obsolete skills on how to chop up bits of celluloid and tape them together with a little guillotine machine.
Right. As we speak into the iPhone at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, when I look at my sons are just now getting into filmmaking a little bit, and my youngest son, whose birthday is today, happy birthday, Sam, if there's no way you'd be listening to this, but
happy birthday, Sam. You never know.
You never know.
He's our biggest fan.
The ability to sit and finesse things, you know, on Avids and Final Cut Pro, is just so enviable, you know, because it's also democratizing, you know, which kind of can get into a discussion of a story like ours. Like, imagine if everyone had access to filmmaking that way, or podcasts using your iPhone, or being able to tweet and you know, social media to take on any kind of oppressive, you know, system. That happens all the time now, but in those days, someone like Hedda Hopper could rule the world in a way, or at least that her little part of the world, by her 32 million readers, by just saying what she wanted to say with very little pushback. You know, there wasn't someone to instantly tweet back at her. So I wonder if
sort of what she said went in a lot of ways. Yeah,
exactly. And that's how the gossip columnists functioned back then. Walter Winchell, Luella Parsons. So, just an interesting difference. There are a lot of similarities, unfortunately, too, with how the political system still suffers from a lot of the same dysfunction.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And you've, you know, since you mentioned Hedda Hopper, let's dive into Trumbo a little bit. I saw it, I guess, last week, and it's just fascinating, but I'm a little biased in that regard because I love movies about, you know, that period of Hollywood and all that kind of stuff.
I think more people love them than we think. I mean, it has become a kind of buzzkill in Hollywood to say, oh, it's got a little political element to it. Like, well, okay, good. Thanks. See you next year. I think the more I talk to people about films, the more they wish there were good political storytelling, you know, there was good political storytelling like there had been in the 70s. Something like 12 million people saw Game Change within the first month, you know, and if that was a Hollywood movie, you know, it probably wouldn't have been as big, but still would have been a pretty hefty. So I was very, only a million saw Recount, so you know, that was humbling. But I would say that I would hope, you know, I can just be naively optimistic that there's a bigger audience for stories. And it's not political, like in quotes, it's just that it's a good story that has a national scope, you know, a scope that's about how then shall our nation run. But the local story is a man and his family trying to survive this horrible situation.
Yeah, did you, what fascinated you, because you'd obviously done Game Change and Recount, you know, and other political things, but what sort of made you want to dive into the McCarthyism, Blacklist era? Did you, God, when I was watching it, I was thinking of Martin Ritt, right, The Front, or something you know, Zero Mostel jumps out the window, it's all, you remember the tragedy in Woody Allen, obviously, but were you a fan of a movie, like, in that sort of genre? Or?
I had a personal connection. When I was at USC Film School, my directing teacher was Edward Dmytryk.
Oh, wow.
He was one of the Hollywood Ten. He was the only non-writer of the Hollywood Ten.
So that's the connection.
That was part of it. I knew a little about it. John McNamara, our great screenwriter, and one has to repeatedly mention him because he's the one who spotted the power of this story about a screenwriter. It took a screenwriter to recognize it, and he worked on it for many years before he brought it to me. I just happened to, coincidentally, he had studied with some of the blacklisted screenwriters, and I had studied with the blacklisted director. And there's only 10 of them, and we each studied with with members of the. So, I knew enough about it. The sad part about it was that his story was a cautionary tale, and which kind of made it more compelling to me. He didn't name names at first, but he came out of prison and did name names to rehabilitate his career.
Right.
Succeeded in rehabilitating him, went on to direct Caine Mutiny, which I think was either nominated or won an Academy Award. And you know, but he was tortured by that, by some of what went on, and never entirely forgiven by his peers in Hollywood. So I was like, there was a little bit of a tragic quality to him that always stuck in my mind.
Wow. And you mentioned naming names and sort of that, you know, certain people come across, certain really famous stars that we all look back at the Golden Age, some of them come across better than others. Let's, you know, you know, Kirk Douglas comes across a little better, and then maybe, you know, Hedda Hopper and, what do we say, maybe John Wayne and Edward G. Robinson, who names names. How do you sort of juggle that? Because, you know, a lot of people sort of have these myths of their favorite movie stars. Do you sort of just take the line sort of in the end, how it's sort of, how Cranston says in the end, it's almost like a healing, you know, we were all sort of victims here. Is that how you kind of straddle that? Or?
I wish it was that simple. A lot of, so it was a situation where these writers, and what, just to get back to your earlier question and then connect to this one. Dalton Trumbo was one of the most talented screenwriters of his day, and most highly paid. You know, well, you know, there are a lot of, there have been probably movies that are held in higher regard than some of his, but imagine what he could have written in those 13 years that he was forbidden from for writing from for studios. The only way he got to write, and this is what made the story compelling, is he wrote in the black market with other writers and for producers, schlock producers like Frank King.
John Goodman.
Who's played by John Goodman, who's fantastic and actually really funny in the story. and he somehow figures out a way to keep writing and under pseudonyms, under false, you know, other fronts or other people or made up names. So he goes and wins two Academy Awards, one for Frank King's company called The Brave One, a movie called The Brave One, and one writes Roman Holiday, Audrey Hepburn's first movie with Gregory Peck.
She won for that one too.
And beautiful, beautiful fairy tale story. Then writes Spartacus, right, and Exodus, all while being blacklisted. So he uses the situation, or he survives the situation and copes with it by just writing, and he writes his way out of both literal jail and figurative movie jail to do this great work. So I was like, how did, that's a story. That's an un-American underdog story who takes on this giant, you know, evil system and kind of wins, but kind of lost something really tragic, which was 13 years of the opportunity to write. Who knows what he would have written.
If we all been, lost those 13.
We lost the civilization, lost out on our artists' output. Many, many hundreds of artists. And if you fold in academia and all the other places where McCarthy, you know, McCarthy came on a little later. This was pre-McCarthy's era when Hedda Hopper was. And so to get back to the difference between someone like John Wayne and someone like Kirk Douglas, despite Dalton Trumbo saying that there were no heroes and no villains, there were people who made choices that were a little more noble than other people. Right. It's on a continuum. It's definitely not black and white. There's the far extreme were people like Hedda who believed that once a commie, always a commie. She got Charlie Chaplin deported, you know, and said on her, practically on her deathbed, just don't let Charlie Chaplin back.
Yeah.
And then you had people all the way down to Trumbo's situation who had a choice to take the risk to lose their career. Some people lost their families, their homes. He lost his home. To stand up for something, a principle that you should be allowed to join any political organization, you know, because the Constitution protects people who join even unpopular organizations as long as they're not literally, you know, part of a plot. But they couldn't even expose a plot. They had all those hours of testimony. There was no evidence whatsoever that these particular men, unlike others in the Communist Party, had anything to do with anything other than just writing great stuff, fighting for unions, fighting against fascism, and unified, probably naively, by the, you know, joining the Communist Party. But none of them were good communists. Trumbo was constantly attacking, you know, any criticizing the Communist Party, and also was busy making, you know, a ton of money. So he was a hypocrite. They didn't. He was a bad communist if he was a communist.
Right.
And that's why we had Louis C.K. playing the far left version to bust him for all that.
Right. Right. No, yeah. And that's awesome. I guess let's go into Brian. Was this an idea where you came to the material first, or did Brian come to it first, or how did he get cast as Dalton Trumbo?
The screenwriter had worked for years on the project and had done a ton of great work. And then it was brought to me by Michael London, our great producer, and I worked with the screenwriter on it for a couple more years. And we, you know, found new things. Hedda Hopper became a bigger part of the story. We got to know the daughters of Trumbo, Mitzi and Nikki Trumbo, who added a tremendous amount of authenticity, details, specific moments of, you know, difficulty in their home, and we just kept doing it. And then the financiers that we talked to wanted bigger names, but when Cranston's name come up, you know, I just said I don't want to do it unless it's him, you know. And we hung in and found a really cool company to finance it. And Brian, there's a lot of overlap, I think, with Trumbo and Cranston, because Brian's so passionate and so driven, and he can be kind of larger than life too. He's so charismatic, you know. And look at the range from Malcolm in the Middle to Breaking Bad,
to Seinfeld,
all those character roles he played,
Argo, Private Ryan, he was in too, by the way.
That's right, of course.
Lots of stuff.
And so I just thought I need that range to make this character relatable, because he's a communist, he's rich.
No one's gonna go for this if we don't get the 40s,
and he's a writer. Right. Like, these are all the things, and it's in a political story. These are the probably the five least commercial things you could ever want to try. And so I just thought, you got to have someone as good as Cranston, and the same for all the other characters. You had to have someone as good as Helen Mirren playing Hedda. You had to have someone good as Stuhlbarg playing Edward G. Robinson. Yeah. John Goodman as Frank King is just mind-blowingly good, and as they say, funny. And Louis C.K. as this composite of the other Hollywood 10 writers, you know, as the very dark, dry, unhealthy man, ultimately, who also happens to be hilarious as he's trashing Trumbo.
Yeah. I love the little stuff you sneak in there, like breaking in Goodman's office, how they break the Gun Crazy poster. Like, oh, he makes trash, except this movie we're going to punch that everyone holds up. So there's some cool stuff you got going on.
I love that he also says, you know, go ahead, shut me down. I'll just go hire winos and hookers to be my crew. And if you do whatever you want in the press, because nobody who sees my movie can read. So he just, like, he embraced his schlockiness.
Yeah.
And then again, he goes on and helps these guys, these great screenwriters who he's paying nothing. He exploited the crap out of them.
Right.
But he let them work, and he didn't care if they were blacklisted. Yeah. And he gets Brave One written and helps contribute to Trumbo emerging to do all these other great films.
You're talking about, there's this interesting sort of paradox with this schlocky stuff versus the higher brow stuff that he wins Oscars for. But talk about your career is almost in that. You know, tell me how comedy is also a serious art. Like, I don't think enough people appreciate it.
I wouldn't agree that there's any schlock in Austin, but I did work for Roger Corman for a little while after film school shooting. You know, I remember I was a cameraman and I would shoot like a stripper's pillow fight, you know, with feathers, and then he was involved in some horror film. I'd be like, I know schlock.
Yeah.
But
tell me how comedy is more of a serious, you know, I don't think enough people give it a credit for. Well, Austin Powers and Meet the Parents are genius.
I appreciate that. Thank you. I didn't intend to do comedy. I mostly wrote in film school. I did some comedy, but I mostly wrote when I came out in serious stuff and science fiction and family drama. I mean, I was a writer and made a living in that world where you develop things that never get made.
Right.
But then when Mike Myers and I met, somehow I connected back to my older roots of Monty Python and Woody Allen, and he said, you should do this movie. And then I got on a treadmill in a way, but a very great, hilarious, fun treadmill that I just, you know, kept doing those films. And when I had mentioned to Sidney Pollack once that I was really interested in doing and he was going to do Recount, and then he got sick and couldn't, and he actually died just a little while after the film opened on HBO.
This but is Tootsie and The Way We Were, all this stuff, yeah.
Jeremiah Johnson and Thin Red Line, and I mean, this, you know, not Thin Red Line.
Out of Africa.
There's a bunch of movies. Yeah, a bunch of movies.
Anyway, just for the record, that's Sidney Bosch.
He was an incredible director, and he said, oh, I need some help, I need someone to take over this film, and he hadn't really got to do much on it yet, so I had to start from scratch, but it was 8 weeks of, you know, there was a reason why I was the only person sort of eager enough to take it on. There was no prep time, and but it was an opportunity of a lifetime to get back into doing stories about serious topics.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just love this, again, I love the story of the man, Ron Klain, who had helped Gore fight the recount battle. I love the story of Steve Schmidt, the guy who had chosen Sarah Palin and then had to figure out how to...
Woody Harrelson in the movie.
Yeah, Woody Harrelson in that movie, and it was Kevin Spacey who played Ron Klain in the other one. It was it's the story about the individual, you know, but the great thing about those stories is there's this larger stakes, and I think that's classic storytelling, the way those screenplays came at me. So I'm going to keep doing all types of stories. I'm actually interested in doing thrillers now. Maybe it'll be a political thriller, maybe it won't have anything to do with politics. You know?
Speaking of that semi political thriller genre, one of your former co-stars is directing Spotlight coming out the same day in D.C. as Trumbo.
I know. Tom McCarthy's he's not only was Dr. Bob in Meet the Parents, the rival son-in-law, he is a great guy and made Station Agent, The Visitor, and I cannot wait to see Spotlight. I haven't seen it yet, but...
it's fantastic.
I just am cursing the universe for having us open on the same weekend, because, I was voting for his film, you know, like we came out at the same time, but it sounds like an amazing film, and I'm really, you know, I'm happy on the one hand that there's so many great films out this fall, but it's, you know, it's kind of like, wow, there's a lot of, people have a lot of choices, but I always say, if you see, you know, I said last weekend, if you see one movie this weekend, see Spotlight. If two, see, you know, Spectre, because you just have to probably. And if those are sold out, come and see Trumbo, because it's a really cool film. So I hope people track it down. Cranston's amazing in the film, and so is Helen Mirren.
It's
and
great.
John Goodman. They're really incredible. I think it's actually a really entertaining experience. It's not just good for
you. Yeah, even if you're not geeking out on Hollywood history like us, I'm telling you, you got to see it. You'll really enjoy it. You mentioned Spectre. Talk about how your Austin Powers sort of, it almost like made it into this, it's a spoof, obviously, of the Great Heights of a Mel Brooks or something, or Leslie Nielsen or whatever, but it's also, no, seriously, but it's almost helped the Bond myth, you know, achieve mythic status even more, you know?
It's interesting, isn't it? Because we really weren't trying to do a Bond myth anyway. In fact, I got the job, it was my first film, the first Austin, by saying I would love to encourage you guys to add some other elements into it. Richard Lester movies, you know, the Beals movies, which Mike was on to too, but I brought in things like these Italian heist movies and or The Tenth Victim with Ursula Anderson and Marcello Mastroianni, who, there were films that had a funny pop art vibe to them, you know, like Warhol turned into comedy almost. Yeah. And I tried to convince them that style can be funny. It's not just, you know, a lot of Hollywood movies at the time, particularly movies that were trying to make, you know, a skit into a larger thing, would just be kind of brightly lit for a reason you couldn't understand, or just, I don't know. So I thought, try to make it have a voice, a vision that's extols the color of the joy of Austin Powers, like his character expanded and manifested in color and dance and movement and big set pieces. I was really pitching for big old, you know, Busby Berkeley style, Buster Keaton level physical comedy.
Yeah.
And Mike really loved that. And and that's, you know, I think that's how we were able to distinguish it. But it was some Bond and some not. And then, of course, Dr. Evil is almost pure Bond mixed with Lorne Michaels.
So funny.
And so now I heard recently that Spectre has an element of the two brothers reveal thing. And I was like, oh, that's
cool. I don't want to give
anything away. But that sounds fascinating, that there might be some... we might have inspired something there.
How did you get him to do... Because actually, we just interviewed Eddie Murphy. He got this award at the Kennedy Center. But how did you work with Mike to do all those different parts? I mean...
you know, him...
Are you directing him differently in each one?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. You'd come at each character just as you would with an actor just playing each individually. But when he was playing Dr. Evil, I've never seen anything like the level of channeling some other spirit that wasn't... Mike Myers in real life is a little closer to Austin.
Right.
As Dr. Evil, he became something else. It was a little Lorne Michaels, so he might have been channeling, you know, his mentor, Lorne.
Right.
But he became so lucid and fluent in a language that wasn't really Mike. It was trippy to watch. And we had many, many hours, really, of just improvs that Dr. Evil would go off talking about the crazy details of his life. In the first one, that long therapy session where he's talking about Somersing, Rangoon, luge lessons, beaten with in a burlap bag, you know, all that stuff.
My father would make outrageous claims like he invented the question mark.
So I'm glad you remember that just, line. Oh my God,
everybody
really know these
does. Films. Everybody.
And, you know, it was so different from directing. And I remember when he one time was in the scene with Seth Green, and they started shushing each other, you know, and that I had shot the whole one side. And the first one, it was just, you know, and every time he started talking, he goes, and he was doing that off camera. It wasn't part of the script.
Yeah.
So I had shot the whole half of the scene, and he and Seth started doing it. But just because he was channeling this other presence, I said, this is too good, and I made them. We went a half day behind. I said, we've got to turn around and shoot it now because it's working so well.
Yeah.
And so, I don't know, with Austin, we would focus, we would talk a little more about, you know, we had to kind of work a little harder, if you will.
Yeah.
With Dr. Evil, it was like, I just made sure the cameras had enough film, and we were actually shooting film, you know, at the time. And that was really magical.
I think it'll be around forever. Everyone loves it.
You know, it's so funny. I've done polls at college. Say, how many of you haven't seen it? And this is not because I'm actually interested in the marketing of how that movie got out, because it didn't get seen in the first theatrical release that much. It made a little bit, but not a huge amount. Then it got big on video, and it's still in the red. Accounting wise, the first Austin Powers, and I'm always like, really? I haven't met anybody. Yeah. Very many people haven't seen that first one on tape. Like, didn't they make some money on it? That it was only cost $16 million to make. It was a relatively low budget movie. So have your friends ask New Line what happened.
We'll ask. I'm sure the sequels made it back. Well, I want to wrap it back around to Trumbo in the end. But before I get there, before we leave the comedy, is there one scene in Meet the Parents that makes you just lose it, even after seeing it?
There's no question. It's the scene, you know, in the dinner when they're sitting around talking about Greg Fokker, you know, having milked a cat, and then
did you get De Niro to do the, or did
no,
Ben to
ben
do
did
it?
That. Yeah. Ben did the little him. Miming of the cat nipple squeezing, and De Niro saying, you know, I have nipples, can you milk me? And and then leading up to the climax of that scene, and it was a 30-minute setup that led to the champagne cork knocking that urn with the ashes.
Yeah.
30 minutes, the whole setup of the first act is just to set up that one giant explosion. And when you sit in an audience and you hear them react to that, you can understand why comedians and film directors get so addicted to the out of body thing that somehow happens. Where I always like it when the audience is losing their minds enough that they're just, you know, thrashing themselves and rocking in the chair. And I got to see that once in Borat, which I produced during the naked fight. I saw people lose their minds.
It was very nice.
That was a great experience in comedy as well.
Awesome. Well, maybe this is how we bring it back to Trumbo.
Yeah.
So, you know, you got, you know, you have someone like De Niro in Meet the Parents who is such a serious, but then you find the comedic side in him. And now you have someone like Cranston who's done Seinfeld and Malcolm in the Middle, but then can go to Breaking Bad and Trumbo. Yeah. And there's, you know, just talk about how are they actually not that different from each other? Because as a director, you've done them both. So how does sort of the same principles apply, I guess?
Well, there's comedy in Trumbo partly because Trumbo himself, though, was a very, very serious man with very serious battles to fight, including for freedom and civil rights, free speech. He also was a witty person, and he was surrounded by wits. The guys, the other Hollywood 10, when Trumbo died, he was older than the rest of them. And so they all came to his funeral and just started trashing the crap out of him. It turned into a roast in a really funny way. They loved him dearly, but they would... still hurl insults, and it actually turned into like a Comedy Central roast, right? So they're that funny. So that's why you cast Louis C.K. and John Goodman. And once you do that, once you have these guys with that capability, the scene, the funniest scene in a very dark movie, a very painful, I have to emphasize, it's obviously a very serious movie with
stakes are as big as it gets,
In a scene where John Goodman takes on this union guy who's threatening to shut him down, you know, and is saying, you know, I'll just, like, everything we're talking about, just, you try to shut me down, you know. That scene, I knew how to shoot that because it was physical comedy with a great comic performer in John Goodman taking on a great foil in Dan Bechdel, who plays, he's a great, people who know Veep, have known for Veep, playing that union leader. And you know, comedy is comedy, and the audience needed a break then from all the seriousness. And I think there are a number of other moments where there's the absurdity and irony kicks in, and we actually get a surprising amount of verbal, you know, where you can hear how a drama is playing. You sometimes can hear, oh, they're actually paying attention because now they're laughing at the funny parts, so they must have got the serious parts too. So I think I'm lucky that I had training in comedy, and comedy also prepares you for chaos, because sometimes the actors come up with something better than, like I was just describing with Dr. Evil, and you have to just go with it. And this was a great screenplay, but there were times, especially with Louis C.K., when he would come up with something.
The happy accident.
Yeah, happy accident. Or do you have to say everything like it's going to be chiseled into a rock? That's or when he says, oh, just shut up. Like the way he busts Trumbo for being a hypocrite and a blowhard and you know, is so great. And I knew enough from doing comedy that you never say, no, just stick to the script, please. Just do the lines. The lines are fine. You don't need to add new things. I would never say that.
Right.
And I like the chaos when someone throws
it's not something. Chiseled, like you said. Yeah, even your approach can't be chiseled. Yeah,
exactly. So I'm definitely flexible enough to find the entertainment value based on my training in comedy.
Awesome. Well, I know you got, fish and tomato soup coming up, so I don't want to keep you away, but I guess, so let's just wrap it up. So, I mean, so we'll make it the last question.
Yeah, sure.
Well, I mean, what do you want people to take away from this movie, other than the entertaining ride that we're talking about and the flashbacks to their Hollywood, you know?
You know what I like taking out of is it's a message to writers or a film, it's a film celebrating what writers are capable of, because storytelling may be the answer. You know, politicians evidently are not going to stay focused enough on solutions, but storytellers love to try to find what unites us, you know, and so he's a storyteller, and you know, I think anytime you can make a movie that's about storytelling and hopefully told well enough as its own story, that other storytellers will look for ways to follow in the footsteps of a man like Trumbo and fight the fights if you have to, but mostly just stay focused on doing great work, and that's what wins out.
Awesome. Well, this is great work. And look forward to seeing your political thriller.
Thanks. Thank you. I wasn't talking about my work. I was talking about the screenwriter's work.
Sure. No, I was tying it together. So. Thank you so much, sir. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much. Thanks. Right. I really appreciate it.
Oh, no problem. Let me just make sure I save it.
Really good. Really good, actually. That's maybe the best interview I've done this whole trip.
Nice. See, I left it rolling.
Yeah.